Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. Somewhat on or around December 28th, 1989, the grace of God separated me from alcohol. There was a willingness born of desperation that I had at that period of time that helped me become enthusiastic enough to come back into Alcoholics Anonymous and try to start doing the things that I saw other people were doing was leading to their sobriety. I thought that maybe there was a chance that I could get sober too. Alcohol was absolutely killing me. My progression at the time was such that I would start drinking the minute I could start drinking, and I was a blackout drinker, and I'd black out, I'd pass out, I'd come to, I'd start drinking again. It was a miserable, nightmarish, twilight zone type of existence that only really the alcoholic can understand. The misery, the desperation, the loneliness, the anxiety, the self-pity, and everything like that that goes along with alcoholic deterioration. My topic today is love and service. There's an end in between these two. I was thinking on the way down there could be a dash. A dash means the same thing in grammar that an equal sign means in math. And I believe that love and service are the same thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. The manifestation of love of another alcoholic is to be of service to them. I really, really liked all three speakers that were up here. Liam, Beth, Mary Beth, they were all right on the money. This was a very, very special workshop, very special event here, because it was certainly people that were in the Fellowship of the Spirit together, people who have recovered from alcoholism, who can hear it when somebody speaks. If you've recovered from alcoholism and you have an awakened spirit, you recognize other people with awakened spirits. You also recognize people that don't have awakened spirits. And that's helpful in being of service. You know who you could and should be carrying the message to. I want to talk just a little bit about Alcoholics Anonymous in the first decade, because that's going to lead a little bit into how I'm going to present this topic here this afternoon. I have some opinions on what's happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have some opinions on what it was like and what it's like now as far as our fellowship is concerned and how we present the program. But I've done enough studying of the early years of Alcoholics Anonymous to pretty much know what they were doing. They were very enthusiastic in the early days. The people who didn't generate a lot of enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous did not stay. What would happen in the early days is you were brought into the program, which is the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You were brought through the steps in a very, very quick way. I mean, read some of the early literature. And then you were brought to the fellowship, which is basically, you know, how we get together among ourselves. Now, in those early days, the statistics for recovery were really, really high among people who really tried the Alcoholics Anonymous process. They had statistics as high as 93% in Cleveland, Ohio. They kept track for many, many years of the members and how they stayed sober. So there was the spark that took place in Akron that led to the creation of Alcoholics Anonymous was burning very, very strong in the first couple of decades in Alcoholics Anonymous. And basically what would happen is you would try to find a prospect. And a prospect was someone who obviously needed and wanted to recover from Alcoholics Anonymous. If you would carry the message of recovery to them, you would explain to them how you went through the steps and how you had a spiritual awakening that led to your recovery from alcoholism, and then you would see if they were willing to go to those same lengths. If they weren't willing to go to those same lengths, you basically let them have your phone number or told them how to get in contact with you, and you said, you know, take it easy. Nobody would bother dealing with someone who wasn't willing to go through the steps in the early days. And that led to a high rate of recovery, because if there's one thing I understand in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's willingness and enthusiasm are really, really the key to success in working a program and in recovery from alcoholism. Sometimes we need to get that willingness and get that enthusiasm from a power greater than ourselves. There's no doubt about that. But without it, our chances are really slim. So they would have a prospect. The prospect would say something like, "Yes, I'm willing to go to any lengths." And then they became a protege. And as soon as you got them through the steps, you would basically require them to carry that message to other people. So it wasn't unusual for people with 2 weeks sober to be carrying the message to other alcoholics. If you got through the steps, that's the message that you carried. You carried the message of the transformational experience that the steps have engendered in you. And that's really what led to recovery from alcoholism. And as long as you stayed enthusiastic enough to continue to carry the message and to continue to work with others, you are pretty much assured of long-term sobriety and recovery. You know, those are two different things. Sobriety is not drinking, keeping alcohol out of your system. Recovery is the antidote to the spiritual malady that we have. All three speakers that were before me basically described from their experience the spiritual malady very, very well. I don't need to do that again. But I would just say that if you're still restless, irritable, discontented, you still have self-centered fear, you're still worried about what other people think of you, you still have a lot of shyness and situational depression, and where you have resentments that you just can't seem to get rid of. You have a lot of guilt and remorse over the things that you've done in your past. If you're still in bondage to the emotional attachment that those things cause, you haven't recovered from alcoholism, you don't have a spiritual awakening, and you have a lot of step work to do. So find somebody that will do it. Part of my job up here to be of love and service is to tell the truth and not worry about annoying people who may not have recovered from alcoholism and are doing it, maintaining their sobriety a different way. Really unconcerned, as I stand here today about that. But in these early days, that's basically what they did. They got you out there working with others as soon as they could. That's how Alcoholics Anonymous went from 2 people to 2 million. By creating that desire and that need to continue to carry the message. Now, what I think happened, and this is an opinion, but it's a studied opinion, is two things. Number one, a book was written from Akron. Dr. Bob had a little bit to do with it. I think it was one of his sponsees that wrote it. It was called The Little Red Book. Now, if anybody in here has studied Alcoholics Anonymous history and knows anything about Bill Wilson, he didn't stop wanting to be the number one guy just because he recognized that was one of his defects of character. We don't always get rid of all of our character defects. And once the Red Book was written, I believe that Bill wanted a conference-approved text to follow that up. I've also studied some of the letters between Bill Wilson and Father Ed Dowling. Ed Dowling was his spiritual advisor. And in one of those letters, Bill Wilson wrote that as bait to sell the book that was going to contain the 12 traditions, as bait, he was going to put 12 essays on the steps in that book so that alcoholics would buy it. Okay? He knew very well the selfish nature of the alcoholic. He was incredibly insightful into the alcoholic mind and motivations. It's one thing I don't think anyone has ever topped. So the step book was written, and it was published sometime just after 1950. Now, prior to that, what was happening was there were there was a really strong emphasis on taking people through the steps the way the Big Book lays them out. Upon publication of the 12 and 12, what I think happened was, all of a sudden we have a new book, and it's called the 12 Steps. And there's 12 steps, okay? There's 12 weeks and 3 months. That means that you could do a step a week every 3 months, and you'd get through the steps, and you could do that every year. You could go through it 4 times. And wouldn't this be a great idea to start a step meeting? Okay, and we'll do a step a week. Now, what happened when that happened was, because the essays in the 12 and 12 were written to broaden and deepen the concepts that were laid out previously in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they're more philosophical and less mechanical. They don't really cover a lot of the mechanics of the steps. That was done in the Big Book. Bill didn't think we needed more mechanics. He basically thought that by sharing his philosophy and his perspective on the steps at his present point, that this would be a good thing. But what happened is, and Bill would always say this, the good is sometimes the enemy of the best. Is the step book a good book? Yes. But it became the enemy of the Big Book. All of a sudden, everybody starts these step meetings all over the place, and they're using the 12 and 12. I don't know if anybody in here has tried to go through the steps with the 12 and 12, but I have, okay? It was brutal. It made no sense to me. I didn't know what I was, where I was going. You know, the 7 deadly sins, you know, I had 17. But anyway, all of a sudden, Bill Wilson himself dilutes our message. And now we're not going right out of the Big Book every time. We're now using the step book. When I got sober in 1989, you couldn't shake a stick without hitting a step meeting. And here's what happens at step meetings. People share about the step. They read about the step. They talk about the step. They think about the step. But nobody's doing them. You ever notice that in a step meeting? You ever in a night step meeting and somebody raises their hand and says something? Well, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to take this meeting hostage for 10 minutes and tell you what my opinion is on the step if I would ever do it. That kind of crap would never be allowed in a Big Book meeting. Okay? So all of a sudden, we've diluted our own message ourselves. Now, that's our fault. But a second piece of the equation came in. In the 1950s, alcoholism was designated a disease. It got the official stamp of diseasedness. Okay? We're all diseased. We're a good-looking bunch of diseased people. And here, stop today, by the way. I want to say that. But all of a sudden, we're now suffering from a disease. That basically checkmates the insurance companies into treating us or providing some kind of treatment as they would cancer or any other disease. Okay, so all of a sudden treatment centers pop up all over the place. They've got very little clue how to really treat alcoholism. The problem with alcoholism is it's a threefold illness. Spiritual, okay, mental and physical. They can help us with the physical. They can even give us mental tools, but what are they going to do for us spiritually? But they're going to try. I mean, you know, if they're going to charge us $13,000, they're going to give it a shot. Okay? So they bring in Father Martin movies, and they put us all in chairs in a big circle, and they start a group like a bad Bob Newhart show. You know what I mean? Where everybody raises their hand and goes, let me tell you about my day. Oh, my day was terrible. Oh, you wouldn't even believe my day. And then the next person will share, oh, your day. Let me tell you about my day. And all of a sudden now, all of this stuff is coming into Alcoholics Anonymous from the treatment centers. All this ineffective treatment for alcoholism just starts coming in because the floodgates were open. Treatment was available for anybody with an addictive illness, And by going to rehab, they were allowing you to think you had a clue about alcoholism or a treatment process. They allowed you to believe that you've now become educated. So you come wandering into Alcoholics Anonymous and you know everything because your counselor, Barry, told you this, you know, or the nurse said that. So now we're deluded from the outside. So we've deluded ourselves to the outside. All of a sudden, Alcoholics Anonymous is ineffective treating alcoholism anymore. And in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, if you were a real alcoholic, and I'll qualify that in a minute, your chances were almost zero for survival in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. Now, another thing I need to talk about here is the scale of alcoholism. This is something that anybody who is down toward the bottom of the scale, none of them will disagree with me. Usually someone will come up and try to disagree with me who hasn't gone down the scale very far. But there's places in the book Alcoholics Anonymous says that there's differing classifications for alcoholics. I like to, when I first start working with somebody, I like to take them to the chapter to wives where it says type 1, 2, 3, and 4, and I said, look, I want to know where you are on that scale. I'm not grading you. The important thing is your truth. What is your truth about alcoholism? Because if you're a type 3 or a type 4, you got work to do and you got to do it fast. If you're a type 1 or a type 2, you can go to the Bob Newhart meetings. Okay? And you'll be fine. But if you're in real trouble, you need to start working the steps. You need to get a spiritual awakening pronto, or you know what? You're gonna be relapsing Ned. You know what I mean? You're gonna be coming in and out over the years. Jeez, I don't know. And people and the type 1 or 2s are gonna come up to you and say, you must have not really wanted it. You weren't honest, I guess. Or 51% if you wanted to get drunk and 49% wanted, or some horse shit like that. Okay? I don't know anybody that would walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, raise your hand, humiliate yourself, tell everybody you're coming back who didn't have a sufficient desire to stay sober. Okay, none of us walks in here because there's nothing on TV that night. You know what I mean? I don't know about you, but during career day, I never said I wanted to be an alcoholic. You know? This is not the place you want to be seen, you know, by the people who you're going on a job interview the next day or something. You know what I mean? So I just don't buy it. What I see is people who are in real trouble. They're type 3 or type 4 alcoholics, and they're trying to treat their alcoholism like the type 1s and 2s. Now, what I love about a group like this, there's one in Wall, there's one in Manspun, there's some really strong groups that are popping up. And if you really are in trouble with alcoholism and you pop into one of those groups, your chances of survival are infinitely superior than the Bob Newhart group, okay, where your sponsor's going to tell you to be the cookie boy. You know, that's going to be your treatment for alcoholism for the year. I want you to take the cookie commitment. You know what I mean? And you're going to be one cranky-ass cookie dude if you're a real alcoholic. You know what I'm saying? Now, groups like this carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, the original, undiluted message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, alcoholism has not changed since the 30s. It has not changed since the 30s. The treatment for alcoholism has not changed since the 30s. The funny thing about the treatment for alcoholism is it's an unorthodox treatment. And professionals just can't wrap their hand around this. Let's say you pay $13,000 and you go to Happy Hills. You know. Now, if they were to tell you the truth when you were being discharged, they'd have to say, okay, no human power can overcome your alcoholism. Your only hope is to find God. May you find him now. Here's your bill. Okay? They're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. Because it's just really bad business practice. They're going to have, you know, they're going to tell you about THIQs and, you know, make you watch all these crazy movies till you want to kill people. Anybody in here been in treatment and rehab? Now, I'm not saying all rehabs are bad. I'm not. I know the one I went to was. Mine was pathetic, and I didn't even know it for years. But they should have been sued for malpractice by every single person that walked through those doors. There are some decent treatment centers. The better ones try to convince you to get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous before you get out. They'll let you go to outside meetings or whatever. They'll have contact people. And they will encourage you to get active in AA or NA or CA or whatever. And then in the outpatient, if there's any follow-up care, they're going to check up on what your progress is in the 12-step fellowship. The best ones will do that. The worst ones won't care. The worst ones won't care. Now, the spark of love that happened with Alcoholics Anonymous happened when Bill Wilson was detoxing on his bed in Towns Hospital. You'll remember this from Bill's story. The thought crossed my mind that thousands, maybe millions of alcoholics could find help with this solution that I've been exposed to from the Oxford group. When I get out of here, I'm going to carry this message to other alcoholics. Now, a lot of people were getting sober in the Oxford group. There was the Emanuel group, the Jacobi Club. There was a whole bunch of evangelical Christian organizations where they would just scoop you up with the rest of the rollers, and you'd fundamentally change enough. Your personality would change, and you'd do enough spiritual work where you would be placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected from the next drink or the next drug. But the problem with those clubs was, as soon as you stopped participating, you would get drunk again. That happened in the Washingtonians. As long as you were really active, you would get drunk again. Well, the same thing is happening in Alcoholics Anonymous today. So many people want you to become meeting dependent. You know, just have you ever heard somebody share, "Well, you know, I missed a meeting last week. I'm still trying to regroup from it." You know, I was a basket case. I had to go to a wedding, and I missed my meeting. That's not recovery, folks. You know what I mean? We're supposed to be safe and protected, happy, joyous, and free. We're not supposed to become meeting dependent. But because there's a million meetings out there now, everywhere you go, there's meetings. It's easy to fall into that trap and use the meetings like a filling station instead of a place to find prospects and proteges. That's what the meetings are for. Don't go to get, go to give. Because by giving is how you receive in this program. Because it's a spiritual program. And the recovery process from alcoholism is unorthodox. It's hard to wrap your hands around. Because it's a spiritual process. Now, I give a lot of talks at a lot of different places. I've been invited to speak at Rutgers School of Alcohol Studies. I give talks to graduating alcoholism counselors at some of the different colleges in New Jersey. And I do that to try to save some of us. You know what I'm saying? Not because of anybody specifically or I'm not knocking anybody's altruism who gets involved in that. But what happens so much is all the courses are about psychologicals. All the courses are about clinical studies. There's very few courses about spiritual recovery that you have to take to become a master's, you know, with a minor in alcoholism, whatever the hell they do. And I remember this one time I did my shtick, and you know, every once in a while someone takes exception to something I say. I can't imagine, but that happens every once in a while. And this guy follows me out, and he starts coming up to me, and he starts going, "What about shame? What about shame? Don't you have to deal with shame?" And I'm like, "No." And he's like, "What?" You know? And I'm like, "Let me ask you a series of questions and be really honest with me. Okay, have you ever inventoried everyone that you've harmed?" And he goes, "No." And I go, well, then you probably haven't shared that with God and another human being, the harms that you've caused. He goes, no. And I go, I guess then you've not ever become willing to have the character defects that cause those harms removed. And he said, no. So I guess I doubt you ever got down on your knees and asked God to remove those character defects that have caused harm. And he said, no. And I go, that means that you never put a list together of the people you had harmed and became willing to go make direct amends to them for where your character defects have caused harm. And he goes, no. And I go, well, I guess you never went out and made amends to these people that you feel guilt and shame and remorse. You never made direct amends to them. And he goes, no. I go, then how do you know if you have to deal with shame? You know what? You know, you're trying to tell me that no matter what you do, you're going to have to deal with shame. I'm telling you what worked for me through my own experience. You're giving me an opinion on an experience you've never had. Why don't you do what I just said and then come back to me and tell me it didn't work? Because Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. It's not something that you learn intellectually. It's experiential because the results come from the actions. It's not a theory. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a theory. It's a way of living. And if we live that way, we're able to maintain our spiritual condition. We're able to participate in the maintenance of our spiritual condition. And when we do that, the other things fall into place. And that's what I mean by an unorthodox treatment. Addictive illness as an unorthodox treatment. And I'm telling you, we're getting pummeled on every side. Not only are we coming under attack from those within, you know, who just want to be able to come in like it's a coffee clutch and share their things every week, and they get really annoyed when somebody brings up a solution because, God, they never needed that. You know, not only are we under attack by mediocrity in the meetings, but we're under attack by the people on the outside. We're under attack today by the professionals and the people who want to write books and the people who want to make money off of alcoholism and drug addiction. Because there's a lot of money out there. If one in ten people in this country suffer from alcoholism or drug addiction, there's a lot of money to be made if you can come up with a solution. So there's always books being written. You know, AA, Cult or Cure. I mean, we get attacked on all sides. Or some muttonhead will come up with a pill. You ever see anybody that's been around long enough knows that about every year and a half a new pill comes out that's going to help us. I remember this one pill came out. You take one pill a day, and you'll be able to drink two drinks normally. When I saw that, I go, I wonder what 12 pills a day would do. You know, I'll be able to drink 24 drinks normally. See, you can't give us a pill. You can't, it's a spiritual illness. The root of our illness is a spiritual illness. We're uncomfortable with ourselves, our environment. We suffer from every kind of emotional pain and bondage. I mean, we are restless, irritable, discontented. We are not well wrapped. Okay? And you know what alcohol does for us? When you crack the top of that bottle, you know what happens? This is what you do. So there's an answer to our illness in the bottle. We're treating our alcoholism with the alcohol. A lot of these experts think that the problem starts with the alcohol. The problem starts in our mind and in our emotional state. We just aren't right. There's something missing. The best way I ever heard it described is as a God-shaped hole. And the emptiness that we feel because of this hole is too much to bear sometimes. And we just can't bear it. And we'll get into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we'll be in the Bob Newhart group, and we'll be sharing our stuff. And that hole is going to still be there. And you know what? We try to fill it with whatever the hell we can fill it with. We'll fill it with sex. We'll fill it with gambling. We'll fill it with anything that we can find. We'll become obsessive compulsive in every way you can become obsessive compulsive, trying to stuff that spiritual void that we have. The answer is to fill that spiritual void with a connection with God. And you can't put a price tag on that. You can't go off to 28 days and get that. You can't go to a professional and get it. You certainly can't get that from a pill. You can't get that except to experientially work toward a relationship with God. Once you've done that, all of a sudden, everything's fine. You know, the reason, sometimes I'll identify myself as a recovered alcoholic. Now, depending on where you are, you can get some people that are going to take exception to that after the meeting while they're shaking your hand and smiling at you, you know, telling you that you're a horse's ass to say that you're cured of alcoholism. Well, I didn't say I was cured. I said I was recovered. The difference between cured and recovered, I believe, is this. And this may be my own semantics, but this is what I believe it is. If you have cancer and you're cured of cancer, the disease has been removed. Okay, if you have cancer and you've recovered from cancer, you still have the cancer, but the symptoms have been removed. Okay, in alcoholism, the best you can ever hope for is to have the symptoms removed. You're always going to have the alcoholism. But having the symptoms removed puts you in recovery. Okay, so I'm a recovered alcoholic because I don't have those symptoms. And I'm not talking about drinking. I'm talking about the psycho-emotional mental turmoil that we go through. I just don't have it anymore. I mean, I go to a beginner's meeting every single Monday night for almost 20 years now. And I do it to see the face of alcoholism in a primal state. The people that come into these meetings are shattered. They can barely talk. They're like overcome with shame and anxiety about sharing. It's like a big deal just to raise their hand and say their name. I mean, they're tortured with self. They're in bondage to alcoholic self. And I get to see that every single week to know so that I can say to myself, you know, I was there. I was there. And I can go up to these people and I can say, I know exactly how you feel. And I'm very good at describing that. And I'll describe exactly where they are. I'll bet you were worried about people looking at you when you got up to get coffee, weren't you? How'd you know? Listen, man, I was there, okay? I was there. But I'm not there anymore. I'm not there anymore. There's a way out. I know the way out. I've been where you are, and I got out. I know the way out. You want me to help you find the way out? You know, come over to my house. Come over to my house, and we'll start working on the steps. Now, another thing that you have to understand with alcoholism. Inherent in alcoholism is an utter inability to accurately assess the amount of trouble you're in as an alcoholic. If you're in here today and you're new, just come back, or have not been to the steps, you are in way more trouble than you think you are. Ask the rest of us. You're minimizing like a sumbitch. You know what I mean? Because I'll go up to somebody and I'll help them identify with the first step, the obsession of the mind. I'll bet you've made a whole bunch of resolutions never to drink again, and you meant it, didn't you?
Yeah.
And I'll bet you drank anyway, even though you didn't want to drink.
Yeah.
And I bet once you started drinking, you had little or no control over how much you drank. You shut the bar down, you woke up with a summons in your pocket, you came to a Topeka with one shoe. You know, I mean, how many crazy things have happened to us? So, and they'll say, yeah. And I'll go, I'll describe the emotional malady. I'll say, I bet you're just nervous about everything. You know, you're guilty, you're nervous, everybody's a jerk, and your boss is an asshole, and your family's just really just pushing it, you know, and you got all that stuff going on, right? Yes, it's terrible. Well, okay, that's alcoholism. And the worst part of alcoholism is when you get to drink yourself to death, which you'll have very little control over stopping if you don't find some kind of treatment. Do you understand? Well, yeah. Okay, tomorrow I want you over at my house. Bring a big book. We're going to start working on the steps.
Oh, wow, man. Well, tomorrow, I got to go to a Dead concert. You see, in July and August, I always tour with the Dead. I would be coming over to your house, but I got the Dead thing.
What thing you understand? But I mean, everybody in here that's sponsored understands what I'm talking about. It's hard to get through to them because they don't know how sick they are. They don't know how sick they are. Start to get good at carrying the message of the illness and carrying the message of recovery. That's how you save lives. You need to get good at that. Alcoholics Anonymous is doing a terrible job today. Our membership goes down every year. You know what I'm saying? It's like, well, it's just doing a horrible job at capturing the alcoholic and offering a solution. Because we've let the treatment centers take over all of our work. We let them do the 12-step work. You know, you get a call, somebody's drinking, the first thing you think of, get them to Happy Hills. Okay? Well, they only did that, they got somebody detoxed medically for the befogged. They got them medically detoxed. Then they brought them into their house and offered them recovery. We're allowing the treatment centers, which they're getting fewer and further between, we're allowing them to do our job for us. Now, 1992, because the insurance companies were kind of pushed into addressing alcoholism because it was a disease, 1992, there was 36,000 beds in this country for addictive illness. Managed care came in. Anybody know about managed care? Anybody on HMOs? You know what I'm talking about, right? Within 2 months, there was 3,600 beds. All right. Were we ready? Not in 1992. Not in my area. We weren't ready to start bringing them into our houses. And we were so used to having unlimited beds and unlimited rehabs that we've gotten soft. But all of a sudden, now we've really got to step up to the plate. Because it's hard. It's hard to get long-term treatment anymore. I don't even know how really effective it is anyway. But what I'm saying is, love and service, we need to remember that our sobriety is directly contingent on how well we carry the message to others and how often we do it. Because it's a spiritual recovery process. It's not analytical, it's not intellectual, it's spiritual. We need to be out there of service. Now, spiritual living is not new. All of the religious texts, all of the philosophical texts that go back 4,000 years are filled with it. The Good Samaritan. I mean, I could go on and on and on. We've known for a long time that compassion and charity were important to our own spiritual condition. We've known that for years. The thing is if you're not an alcoholic, you don't need to do those things to survive. We do. The alcoholic has to be compassionate, has to be of service, has to give up themselves or they die. And I don't always mean die drinking. Sometimes it's worse to die spiritually. Anybody in here know people who have they're just dry drunks, their fire hazards are so dry. They're cranky and they yell at everybody and a real dark perspective on everything. Every glass is half empty, it's not even there kind of people, you know? I mean, that's dying in alcoholic death. Because who wants to live with that emotional negative turmoil that goes on in our lives? We don't have to. Another thing that the book talks about, and again, this goes back to the alcoholic not knowing how much trouble they're in. It says in our book that the alcoholic doesn't know the truth from the false. The life that they're living seems like the only one that they can live. They don't have any experience with a spiritual awakening because they've never had one. Okay? You have to know the stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous experientially. If you've never done a fourth and a fifth step, you'll have an idea of what the hell that's going to be. But you're going to be wrong. If you've never done the eighth step and gone out and made direct amends to the people that you've harmed, you'll have some kind of an idea of what you think that might be like, but you'll be wrong. You have to learn this stuff experientially. Now, an unrecovered alcoholic doesn't know what recovery is, doesn't have an experience with being happy, joyous, and free, unless they had just the right combination of drugs and alcohol. And that was a very, very fleeting happy, joyous, and free. Because, of course, they ended up, you know, asleep in a bush somewhere behind a bar. But for that, you know, that's what we chase. We chase that with the alcohol and drink. But they don't understand it as a living experience because they're so wrapped up in the turmoil of self. What we also need to do is we need to become effective at communicating from our own experience what has happened to us in recovery and to try to assure them that it can happen with them. Sometimes this takes a lot of work. I mean, I've sponsored, I don't know, somewhere between 100 and 200 people in my days, and I've gotten halfway decent at it. Some alcoholics are more ready than others, but I've become about as good as I think I can get at carrying the message of hope to the still suffering alcoholic. Most of the time, they're still not going to believe it's possible for them to feel that good without something in them. But if we can keep at it, if we can help them come to believe that a power greater than themselves can restore them to sanity and wholeness of soul, if we can do that, if we can become more and more effective at it, we're going to capture more prospects and be able to turn them into proteges. I believe, this is my own belief, because this is how it's worked with my sponsors, I've had two, and the people that I sponsor. I believe that there's three stages in a sponsorship. Stage one, get them through the steps. If they're not willing to go through the steps, cut them loose. Tell them to go to the Bob Newhart group. If things get rough, you know, here's my phone number. God bless you. I'm with you. I'll do everything I can to help. But if you're not willing to go through the steps, then I'm not effective carrying the message to you because there's only one way I know to recover from alcoholism. And for me to agree to your abbreviated program is just not going to do you any good, and it's certainly going to be wasting my time. So, here's my phone number. You know, when you come back, give me a call, and I'll be there for you if you want to really seriously address this alcoholism. That's stage one of the sponsorship. Get them through the steps, you go on to stage two. Now, because you go through the steps in, let's say it takes you 2 months, you go through the steps, does that mean you're going to have answers to every single question in life sober? No, you're still going to be shooting yourself in the foot because we're a very imperfect people. We've used faulty tools for so long in our lives that we're going to continue to use them until we just can't use them anymore because that's the way we are. We'll shoot the horse until we run out of bullets. It's more of a mentoring process. And how I'll do that is I'll mentor by sharing my experience, not telling them what I think they should do, by telling them what I've done and what happened when I did it. Okay? The worst thing you can do to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous is give them a bunch of opinions on things that you really don't have any experience with. Okay? Like if somebody comes up to me and they've got an issue with tax evasion. Well, I haven't paid my taxes since 1913. I've got nothing to share with them because that's not been my experience. But I know people who've done that and who've made direct amends to the IRS. So as part of my mentoring process, I'm going to put the two of them together, and I'm going to say, hey, Howie over here made direct amends to the IRS. It wasn't pretty, but he got through it, and now he doesn't have to look over his shoulder anymore, which is key to recovery, not having to look over your shoulder. So I'll hook him up with Howie. Now, if I have personal experience with something, I'll share my personal experience and what happened to me. That's part of the mentoring process. The part that sometimes gets forgotten about is the peer process. It's as we walk hand in hand down the broad highway together. I believe that after someone's gone through the steps, after they've learned some of the life lessons, that there are peers now. We don't need, you know, I sponsored this one guy for 18 years now. I've been sponsoring the same guy. I don't order him around. I don't make him wax my car. You know what I mean? There's nothing better about me than him. You know, we're now friends. And I will share I'll share the stuff that I need to share in a 10 step with him, and he'll share the stuff that, you know, I may be sponsor in name, which is fine, but I don't hold any status above him. You know, and I believe that from my own experience, that's a healthy way to sponsor, because what you want to do is you want to get them through stages 1 and 2 as quickly as you can so that they can start living a spiritual life and start developing their relationship with God, who is going to solve all their problems. Anyway, I'm not going to solve anybody's problems. You know, I can share my experience and I can be a channel of the recovery process, but you know, once I start being holier than that, oh, here's what you should do with your business. I think you should do. Well, have you ever had a business like that? No, but you know, I think I'm not going to do that. So anyway, I believe that that's a healthy way to do it. Now, love and service with groups. I believe that the highest form of love is honesty, compassion, charity, and service. Okay, so however you set up your home group, and there's a lot of different ones. I love the solution group meetings, but I don't think every meeting should be a solution group meeting. I think there should be a cross section of different types of meetings, because otherwise you'd have all the ones and twos in your meeting. You know what I mean? And sometimes it's better to have a cross section of different types of meetings for different types of people in different stages of their alcoholism. But I love these solution groups because for the longest time, they didn't exist. When I got sober, there were no solution meetings in North Jersey. Not that I knew about. They weren't around. And when they started at places like Berkeley Heights and Burnsville and Hackettstown and a couple of other places. Man, you want to talk about getting some bad press? What those people are doing over there, they're carrying around the big book. Stay away from them. I mean, there's still people in my area that warn people away from the Burnsville man. You know, so it'll stay away for like 5 or 6 years and then maybe go one night and say, hey, this is great. You know, the pendulum had to swing. Alcoholics Anonymous as a fellowship, the fellowship meetings had gotten so bad, the pendulum just had to swing back the other way. And we had to start getting some of these literature-based recovery groups like this. We needed them, okay, just to balance out the playing field. Ultimately, what would be the best thing is for everybody to feel a unity, not this disparity between the big book groups and the oral tradition groups, but for there to be a unity in Alcoholics Anonymous, and for one side not to resent or be afraid of the other. You know what I mean? If you walk into any home group, there should be people who do it by the book and people who don't. And depending on where you've gone down the scale, you'll be able to point the people to the right people who can help them, the people with the common problem, the people with the same experience, so that anybody coming into Alcoholics Anonymous, anywhere from having a drinking problem to being almost dead of alcoholism, is going to find hope. You know, that's what hopefully is going to transpire in alcoholism. We're headed that way, where we're headed in a really good direction, at least in North Jersey, because you can't shake a stick without a literature-based meeting starting up. So, I think it's balancing the playing field, and as soon as the egos and the prejudice die down a little bit, I think we're going to have a great amalgam, a great strong fellowship where anybody and everybody can find the message that they need. One of the scary things, though, in Alcoholics Anonymous at this point is if you haven't gone down the scale very far, let's say with a sufficient desire to stop drinking and some fellowship encouragement, you can stay away from alcohol for a long time and your life can get pretty good. Well, the scary thing is, somebody who's in real trouble goes up to them and goes, "Hey man, will you sponsor me?" And they'll say, "Sure." Then they'll say, "You're the new cookie guy." And then that person will die. So again, I think there needs to be, everybody needs to be in the group, so that if you're a lower scale alcoholic, you can recognize the lower scale alcoholics coming in and you can grab them. And if it's somebody who had just a little bit too much to drink at the church social, you'll be able to steer them over here. You know what I mean? Because there has to be room for all of us. But we don't want anybody dying on our watch. We don't want anybody dying on our watch. It's a brutal illness. I want to tell you a little story. A friend of mine was coming down here today, and I was going to tell him this because he was actually working on it. I get a call from my ex-wife. Now, I've got a decent relationship with my ex-wife. That goes to show that steps 4 through 9 are alive and well, folks. You understand what I'm saying? Anyway, she calls me up and she says, "My brother Michael is in trouble. He's in the hospital. Alcohol has put him in the hospital." So she goes, "Is there anything you can do?" I go, "Is there anything I can do?" Oh, this will be fun. I get about 15 guys together, and I start sending them into the hospital, one at a time to tell their story. They're like my sponsees. Rob was one of them in the back there. One at a time, they just start going to the hospital. And finally, he's like, "Oh, my God, where are you guys coming from?" Now, what had happened was, He had worked his way down the financial scale to the point where he was living in a motel on the side of Route 46. And walking in this motel was brutal. I mean, it was a mess. But anyway, he had had congestive heart failure. There's many acute symptoms about alcoholism. There's larynxes that explode. There's car accidents, there's getting shot by somebody that you're pissed off. There's a million ways that you can check out by alcoholism. But what had happened to him was, he had congestive heart failure, and he'd blown up by the Michelin Man. Okay? His testicles were like medicine balls. Okay? You know, this was uncomfortable for him. And so he had to waddle into the hospital. And he's in the hospital bed, right? And all these guys are going, hey, I'm an alcoholic, brother. Well, finally he goes, okay, whatever you want me to do, I'll do. Just stop coming. You know? And so when he gets out of the hospital, he starts coming to AA. Now, he was really, really ill. I mean, alcoholism had really taken him down. And we did the best we could. We really tried to rush him in and make him part of everything, and, you know, we had somebody going up to his house, starting him on the steps. I mean, we really tried to get him involved, tried to get him a bunch of friends. You know how we do that, a lot of encouragement. And one day he walks in and he goes, "I'm just here to tell everybody that I'm resigning." Now, I've never seen this before, never seen it after. Raise your hand. I just want to tell everybody, go, "Thanks for everything, but I'm resigning, and I just wanted to tell you, you know, before I left." So he resigned. You know, that showed a lot of class. Because most people just slime out of here like weasels. They don't say anything, you know what I mean? They're just gone. But he was on. And, you know, we don't chase alcoholics. What I was hoping, you know, if we would have chased him, it wouldn't have done any good. He just would have got another motel and hid from us. But what happened was he went back to drinking. And they found him. They found him a week ago. He'd been dead 2 or 3 days in his motel room. He had drank himself to death. Now, I can't imagine what he's gone through in the last year and a half. Isolation, drinking hard liquor, with all those health problems in a motel, you know, with everybody coming after him for money, he couldn't pay for his hospital stuff. Just that desperation, that loneliness, the self-pity that we suffer from. It's horrible. I can't imagine what he suffered from. But I'll tell you what, I can't imagine what his family's suffering from. Because I talked to all of them. All of them felt guilty that they didn't do more. And I called them up and I said, there's absolutely nothing you guys could have done. We carried the message to him. He saw the message at work. And he turned his back on the message. You know, there's nothing more we could have done. There's a statistical probability that is very, very high that if you're alcoholic, you're going to die of alcoholism. We're the lucky ones in this room right now. We're the lucky ones in this room. Think about this. If 1 out of 10 people are alcoholic, and there's 4 billion people on this planet, how many alcoholics would that be? I'm bad at math. A friggin' lot, right? Like more than 100. How come we have maybe 3 million people in AA? What is that? 2% or something? I don't know. But we should feel very, very lucky. And you know, the other 98% that's out there dying, love and service. Let's find ways to carry the message. I'll tell you how I'm doing it. I got 1 minute left. I'll tell you how I'm doing it. I have a rehab commitment at least once a month. I sponsor like crazy. I go to meetings where I know there's going to be the sick and suffering. Okay, I'm involved with a nonprofit organization called C4 Recovery Solutions. We're really trying to find ways to get the professional community to do a better job with this out there. All right, I do a lot of speaking commitments. I'm all over the place. Last weekend I was speaking in Scottsdale, Arizona. Next weekend I'm going to be in Vermont. I get involved. I'm doing a lot. I feel like I have a bit of a gift carrying the message, so it would be unconscionable not to take advantage of it when people ask me to speak. I find that unconscionable. There's nothing more important, you know, than trying to carry the message to someone who may still be suffering, or carry the message to someone who can carry the message to someone, You know, because there's a ripple effect that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous. You all have probably helped people you don't even know about because it was the people you helped to help them. So love and service. Let's really get involved, okay? When we leave here today, let's make a commitment to do a better job in Alcoholics Anonymous, and let's try to fight alcoholism by helping other people. And if we do enough of that, our lives, our quality of life itself will go out the roof. Thanks for listening.